I'm Sinan Aral, and this is The Digital Insider, where we get to the real hard science behind the digital economy and explore the latest trends in digital business and society with the world's leading thinkers and doers. Hey everyone, Sinan here. I'm so excited to welcome you to the first episode of The Digital Insider. On today's episode, I have the privilege of sitting down with my friend and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Maria Ressa, who shares her fascinating insights on her work as a fearless advocate of journalism and the freedom of speech. She's the co-founder and CEO and executive editor of Rappler.com, an online news organization in the Philippines. She was one of the first reporters to expose the human rights abuses of the former president, Rodrigo Duterte, which culminated in her being awarded the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize. She was the first Filipino recipient of the prize. Today, you'll hear two parts of my conversation with Maria, one from a live recording we did at MIT, and a second from just the other day when Maria updated me on her life now as she awaits the verdict of her appeal for 10 counts of cyber libel while out on bail, and her opinions about the recent Filipino elections. I hope you enjoy it.
So for those of you who don't know, Maria and I met a little over 2 years ago in Germany, and we became fast friends and have been seeing each other mainly on Zoom since then because of the pandemic. For those of you who don't know her, she is not only the tour de force that is the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, but she is also just a fantastically humble and amazing person who I would wish everyone in the world would get to know personally, because she is just such an amazing person. So Maria, my first question, how does it feel to win the Nobel Peace Prize?
It's like, you know that painting?
So I imagine that, you know, now your days are scheduled, every 5 minutes of your days are scheduled and so on and so forth. But how has this sort of impacted the effectiveness with which you can bring your ideas and the change you want to bring to the world? How has this affected your ability to make change, do you think? Or are you just getting a handle on that?
I'm understanding this, but, you know, it's strange because, you know, thank you for coming. But I have been saying the same things. I feel like Sisyphus and Cassandra combined, but more people are listening now. So I'm hoping that we find the solution, or at least the direction. This is what we were like kind of going over. I was like, so I'm unhappy with this. It needs to be more radical. What action can we take now? And I'm hoping that that we can take that light. I think that Nobel Light did two immediate things. One is journalism. All of a sudden it gave a lift to journalists who are under attack, and there's so many of us around the world like that. I am actually lucky because in the Philippines alone, 21 journalists killed in the last 5 years, 63 lawyers killed, tens of thousands of people killed in a brutal drug war. These are just in the last 5 years. Here in Cambridge, I met a journalist from Brazil who is under attack, a journalist who was convicted from Hong Kong, a journalist from Venezuela who is afraid, right? So how do you deal with that? So I guess journalism. The other part is the Philippines. You know, for the people who are trying to hold the line, that all of a sudden that light helped. It was, you're not stupid if you're doing the right thing. Because so much of the incentive schemes, especially when it is towards, you know, these authoritarian populist leaders enabled by digital technology, it feels like you're alone. And I think what this is telling us is that you're not alone. So if you haven't formed your coalition, please help.
So we're definitely going to get to the current day of digital age, because I think that's so important. But I want to kind of rewind the clock and see if we can understand a little bit better how you came to do what you do. And, you know, you started as a journalist before founding Rappler and getting into digital entrepreneurship and building platforms for speech online and so on, you were a journalist. So tell
still am.
Obviously, yes. So tell us, like, what drew you to journalism? What is it about journalism that you found so inspiring and important that you wanted to dedicate your life to it?
I never really made that decision. It was like once, like fighting a dictator, it's one step in front of the other. You just keep doing it. What I loved about journalism was someone's paying you to ask questions, you know, to actually learn. And then even after like almost a decade with CNN, I was climbing this volcano. It was erupting, Mount Merapi in Indonesia. And it still hits me that, oh my God, you know, it is the safest way to do adventure sports. We had support to do it. And you can, I also think I lived through the golden age of journalism where when I joined CNN, it was chicken noodle news. I watched the Gulf War. You know, I had already opened the Manila Bureau, and I watched the world and technology change with the pace of information. So at CNN, my bureau was one of there were 12 of bureaus that would always get the latest technology to test. Digital news gathering is what we called it. But I don't know if you even remember, first the cell phones were suitcases, mm-hmm. you know, that was bigger than me, so it was heavy to carry. And then the next phase was like this vast toko P. Anyone know what that is? Mm-hmm. A toko box, which essentially takes apart the audio and the video and transmits them one by one. So like if you transmit a 10-minute video, it'll take you like 4 hours. And that's in addition to doing the news gathering. And then the cost of satellite technology from 10,000 from Manila for a 10-minute feed, it went to $400. And that meant going from, you know, once a month, maybe a satellite live that you're now getting for free to every hour, mm-hmm. you know. So what made me? Power is information is power. Mm. And justice comes not just from information, but getting power on the right side, right? So I fell into it. I fell into journalism. I loved the form and substance of television journalism. And learning it, the 10,000 hours. So anyone wanting to be a journalist today, if you're at MIT, you're in the wrong school. No, but anyone wanting...
Well, digital entrepreneurship and journalism here, you know, right?
Well, that's actually really cool because now what's happened is I grew up at a time when the creation of journalism and the distribution were intertwined. Now, some of the biggest problems come because we separated them. And the principles, the standards and ethics and the mission of journalism is still with the content, with the journalist, but the distribution, and this is where we go to CNN, this distribution has become evil. So, you know, we need to look at those principles.
Yeah, so let's switch to digital entrepreneurship and journalism. So you founded Rappler in 2012. So tell us a little bit about, you know, that story, how you co-founded it, why you co-founded it, what the idea was, and what do you see as its role in the Filipino media, tech, and political ecosystem?
Okay, so reporter, I ran the bureaus in Southeast Asia and for CNN, and then in 2005, I thought I'm tired of telling everyone else's story and I needed to prove that I could actually build something. So when I turned 40, I decided to choose home. I chose the Philippines. I was old enough to have real experience, but young enough to still be able to work 24 hours a day if I needed to. And I went home to head ABS-CBN, the largest news organization, 1,000 journalists. I did that for 6 years, and then I realized that the things that make traditional news organizations succeed are not going to help them succeed in the new world. And that is when technology came in, right? So
why did you think that they weren't going to succeed?
Because if you're a manager of a large news group, what you did is you managed for efficiency. So when I walked into ABS-CBN, I had an industrial engineer. I do like engineers, follow every single major position in ABS-CBN so I could see, and they did it for a month, right? So then you can Gantt chart it, and then you can see. And then I did the thing that journalists hate. I cut ABS-CBN and made it more efficient. I cut 20%, right? Because if you're a news manager or you're a journalist, most of the time you're going to look at the infinite stories you can do and you will keep adding people. But you have to know what the goal is. What is the goal? What's the most efficient way of doing it? What's the equipment and workflow that I need? So what I learned from managing this large network is that legacy systems take a long time to replace, and legacy culture is corrosive. And so we set up Rappler precisely because I felt like it was easier to start with nothing than it was to pivot.
Leapfrogging.
Yes. And that's exactly what happened. You know, when I brought computers into ABS-CBN, so this was, it would be like 2005, I had 75 reporters in a room like this, and we gave them Macs. So CNN had stress tested, which is better, Apple or Mac? You know, Mac or IBM, that was it, right? Mm-hmm. So we stress tested it, and then every reporter in the room looked at it like an extra chore. And when the same thing happened in Rappler, when we had all 12 of us, including me, in a room, and our Macs came in, it was like Christmas, because it depends on what your expectations are. So it was really tough. Yeah. But I felt that technology was a massive game changer. Mm-hmm. Journalists, we needed to both understand how it would affect the form and substance. And I always wanted to, in 2012, take a phone and have, and this seemed like a dream then, because there wasn't even Mojo mobile journalism. There wasn't around then. So we actually got a metal, like somebody to create a metal case for the phone. We created our own tripod.
Selfie stick.
Yeah, before all of this, right? Remember, we even took an Isuzu chassis and built an IP satellite van, right? Like an OB van for broadcasting.
So you sound completely like a MIT-style entrepreneur right now. Like the kids are doing this.
It was such fun.
In their dorm rooms. Yeah.
You know, that was the best part of starting with nothing, because you can create it. But then I also realized over time, what did we want to do? The Philippines is like, Cambridge Analytica whistleblower Chris Wiley called us a petri dish for Cambridge Analytica. Mm. But for technical, for digital, we're a petri dish. Yahoo, all the other digital rollouts for you here in the West would roll out in the Philippines first. We're a testing ground. And so With Rappler, what we wanted to do was just to experiment. And because I'm a journalist, it was first the form and then transmission. And then when social media kicked in, that would have been, think about it, like when did Facebook Live happen or YouTube Live? The end of 2014, the beginning of 2015. We were up in 2012. And I would go to schools to, the message, I drank the Kool-Aid, social media for social good. Mm-hmm. Social media for social change, mm-hmm. right? And because the median age in the Philippines is young, we're 23 years old. We were the SMS, the texting capital of the world before Multiply was huge in the Philippines. And then today, for the sixth year in a row, Filipinos spend the most time online and on social media. And then I think the other part, starting in 2013, despite the bad speeds that we had, we were uploading and downloading the most number of videos on YouTube. Mm. So fast forward, Chris Wiley, I catch him in Sydney and I sit him down and I go, so what happened in the Philippines? And he says that Cambridge Analytica and its parent company, SCL, had been in the Philippines, and in countries like ours, they tested these tactics of mass manipulation. And if they worked in our countries, then they ported it over to yours. Wow. You know, so we're just the guinea pigs.
So you learned a bunch from journalism, from a managerial business model point of view. And then you saw that porting that legacy into the new world of social and digital media was going to be completely inefficient and not fast enough. So you started Rappler. How did your approach to the business model of Rappler learn from what you learned in the journal, the traditional journalism? And what is the business model of Rappler? How does it, you know, how, why is it so successful?
I'm going to do two phases, right? Please remind me what happened after Duterte attacked us, right? But the first is that what made Rappler different is that we came from the old world. The four founders of Rappler are my age. Right, so there were four or five of us above 40 when we started in 2012. And then we hired the smartest 20-somethings we could find. We wanted to get this fusion, and we thought that was the magic spot. 2011 was when we started hiring. We had managed large organizations, the four founders. I took them away from ABS-CBN, and they came with me. But we managed the only English cable news channel in the Philippines, 24/7. There was the woman in charge of the website that had been more than a decade old. So we had gone through Microsoft switch to open source and Drupal. I mean, we had done two or three different shifts already. It was also the third founder is the standards and ethics person that I had brought into ABS-CBN, who had created an independent news magazine. And then the fourth was the person who created all the newscasts for the top channel. Now, what we did is we took what we knew. The beginning, when you're setting it up, is extremely humbling because you realize how little you know of digital, right? And what we went with what we knew of television, that was an advantage. But then the other part, when you have the 20-somethings, something like video, if I were to do what I had known at that point, I would have gone for a solution that would have cost $18,000 a month. My young guys said, this is free. So, and you know, then you just have to put the guardrails because you have the experience to know where it can go wrong. So it was that. It was a combination of taking what is being built now, knowing the dangers, and adapting it. I think the most fun of those first few years was coming up with something really new by just putting bits and pieces together. Something really new. Here's an example. We started in January 2012 when a Supreme Court Chief Justice was being impeached. And the impeachment trials were running 8 hours a day on video. So what we did was we live streamed it. This is January 2012. So we live streamed it on your cell phone, on your laptop. And as we were doing that, I took Twitter and we mapped the conversation that was happening so that we could understand what conversations were happening and which networks were doing that. So why is that important? Because when you start with zero on Twitter, you want to know who the boundary spanners are that you're going to get to actually look at information cascades. Mm-hmm. So we had built the ABS-CBN account, so we knew who was amplifying what. And then as the account of Rappler, you can then talk to I remember this one Davao lawyer. Davao is the home city of President Duterte. So this is way years before. Davao has a very strong digital base. And what we would do then is build our Twitter based on this is influencers before they were influencers, right? You look for how do you spread a message? You spread it with three different types from social network theory. So now I'm rambling, but it's really fun, right? You experiment with 8 hours a day of live video and conversations on social, which we were driving. You could do lots of things. And then the stories, even the idea of atomizing a story, right? In the past, a reporter would wait until the end of the day before they do it. At that point, we would just like push it out, bits and pieces of it. And I loved it then, and now I hate the atomization of meaning, right? So this is the evolution for me.
So I want to ask you about what happened when the government, the Tuerte, started to attack you and forces that were related. But before that, two really simple questions so that everybody understands what the business model is. What's the sort of order of magnitude scale of the number of viewers of Rappler? And just in a sentence or two, how does Rappler make money? Is it ads? Is it subscriptions? What's the actual engine underneath?
It's very different from 2012 to 2020.
Yeah, okay.
Right? From 2012, advertising.
Okay.
Because I had all the relationships, and so we offered things like founder advertising packages. And so at the beginning, it's advertising. By 2016, when we came under attack, we were still, our advertising revenue was the majority of it. Mm-hmm. But when we came under attack, the advertisers are the first to get scared.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also the first to get phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
And then you become kryptonite. Mm. So when the government tried to revoke our license to operate, Myrish told you we were shut down. We weren't shut down. We fought back. And so we refused to get shut down, which we're live, so I won't tell you how we did. But what we did was, you know, after 4 months, after the government tried to revoke our license to operate and we fought back very forcefully and very publicly, we lost 49% of our advertising revenue. That would have been the war of attrition the government wanted. Probably if we only relied on that advertising stream, we would have gone bankrupt by the end of that year. But what it forced us to do, so this is, you know, the impact of the government's attacks were focused on killing our advertising and scaring our readers.
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 months, we looked at what we had. And this is the other fun part of being an entrepreneur. We looked at everything we were doing, and we realized that our research in disinformation, finding the disinformation networks, which is how we got attacked by the government. In October 2016, we showed you the propaganda machine, how Facebook algorithms impact democracy. We looked at that research and realized that we had a database. We're working on this, right? We had this database we called Shark Tank. At that point, this was just publicly available posts, and now it's over 400 million publicly available posts, comments, everything that is there. And we came up with a business model that, you know, if you're exposing these networks of disinformation as a journalist, what about every person in the digital world or every company that is under attack? Because what we saw in the Philippines is, you know, when the politics, when they're not doing information operations for the government, these accounts, fake and real, would then attack companies for money,
mm-hmm.
right? We mm-hmm. call it ACDC, attack, collect, defend, collect.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came up with a business model, a sustainable business model that relied on our ability to make sense of the digital space. So that natural language processing to look at the messages and then looking at the networks, mapping the networks of disinformation. Rappler remains one of two Filipino fact-checking partners of Facebook. We will look at the lie, and then once we find the lie, we'll track the networks.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Toyota, you know, and you want to see both what has been published about you and what is being said on social media, how would you do that? If you use a tool, you'll get some numbers, but you won't know what it is. If you take natural language processing and get the data together, you can actually segment. You can look at how your brand is evolving on social media. So this is how we survive. That business model grew 2,000% in 2018. So in some ways, crisis is opportunity.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good way to put it. And we're working on this now together, which I think is going to be very exciting. But I want to ask you, so you began by talking about how journalism inspired you in the sense that it is the light. It shines a light, and it is that information is power idea is important. And so Rappler has focused a lot on, you know, things like extrajudicial killings and corruption and the drug war and all of these topics in the Philippines. So I just want to ask you a little bit about, you know, why do you think it's so important to have social justice as part and parcel of journalism and integrated into entrepreneurship?
It's the mission of journalism, isn't it? I mean, this is the fun part of the mission. The more we saw the horror of what the technology was enabling, and we saw the horror, I saw it personally. You don't really know what an information operation is like on social media until you're attacked. And when you're attacked, if you're attacked, think 90 hate messages per hour, right? Per hour. When you're attacked, you also see it evolve over time. And so I think the first part of that was realizing that we're in a whole different space and a whole different time. And if I'm feeling this and I'm being attacked this way, then what will happen? So it's happened to me, it happened to Rappler. Bottom-up attacks are the same. This is the same methodology used against you. And then the government, our government then came top-down.
So what is the bottom-up and what is the top-down?
The bottom-up is a meta-narrative, a seeded meta-narrative, right? That most people will think you're going to have to stop the virality. I think the public debate is too focused on content. Mm-hmm. It is the entire system that you look at, right? So seeding a meta-narrative, in 2016, the government seeded journalist equals criminal. Just seeded it, which is about tearing down your credibility. And it was focused on me, on Rappler, on ABS-CBN, which lost its franchise, closed for the first time in 14 years since Marcos, since the days of Ferdinand Marcos and he declared martial law. You say that lie a million times, you pop it up every now and then, and sometimes it goes viral and then it drops. But what it does is when you're on your cell phone, and let me quote that book, The Hype Machine. when you're on your cell phone, this is a perpetual loop, right? Whether you click on it or not is a data point. And if you're Facebook or Spotify or YouTube, whatever you're on, you're helping build a model. Machine learning is taking everything you do and building a model of you that oftentimes knows you better than you know yourself, right? When you do that, that perpetual model becomes, I call it a behavior modification system now, right? Because the algorithms of each one of these platforms incentivize behavior. If you're putting in content that you want your friends to see, when Facebook, and we know this from the papers that were released by Francis Haugen, when they weigh anger five times, you are incentivized to be angry. It pumps anger through the connective tissue, right? The world's largest distribution platform for news prioritizes anger in that scenario. Here's the other thing, the 2018 study that CNN and his team did here in MIT also showed that lies laced with anger and hate spread faster and further than facts. I spent my entire career, 35 years as a journalist, trying to make facts interesting. So it holds your attention. But now in social media, you don't have to. You just lie and you add anger. And if your goal is to be an influencer, then now that's influencer. What about if you're doing information operations, mm-hmm. right? If you're the IRA or the GRU or the Duterte administration, or Chinese information operations. This was taken down last year, September 2020, by Facebook. Information operations originating from China, creating fake accounts for the US presidential elections using AI-generated photos. That same information operations was targeting the Philippines. It was attacking me and Rappler. So this is how I know about it, but it was polishing the image of the Marcoses, and it was already campaigning for the candidacy of the daughter of President Duterte for our May 2022 elections. right? Think about the planning that went there and how it cuts across.
That is exactly the question. And so now we arrive squarely at the conversation that you and I always have, which is, I think, right now the most important question, which is, what do we do? Which is why I wrote my book and why you and I always talk about this. So, and before we started here, you know, we're always comparing notes. What do you think now? Like, what is the latest and greatest idea for what do we do now? And so that's the question is, we don't even have to tell this crowd the dangers of, what social media might be doing in terms of the spread of lies, in terms of what it might do to democracy, potential impacts on elections, misinformation about COVID, obviously, you know, and how that's affecting the public health, and so on. So we've got a litany of possible catastrophic harms. And the question is, what do we do? What is your latest and greatest thinking about what we could do to clean up big tech and social media?
We have this debate all the time because he's much more reasonable than I am now. And now we've gotten to a point where, you know, we've lived with this since 2016. Character assassination, I mean, every single animal you can think of, I've been called, I've seen my head and my photos, the face placed on. I have eczema, really dry skin. So the machine created this meme of me, my head on human genitals, scrotum face, right? You wake up to this, you kind of go, oh my. Yeah, not such a good day. But in 2016, I was all for, okay, let's give the platforms the benefit of the doubt. You know, because I lived through CNN when we grew. By 2018, when Cambridge Analytica happened, and they still weren't doing anything, the end of 2017 was when Mark Zuckerberg said, only 1%. 1% of what? Right. Look at all the statements that they've made. 2018, Cambridge Analytica happened. We became fact-checking partners of Facebook. I was still working behind the scenes. In 2016, I went to them and I showed them the data, how 26 fake accounts can influence up to 3 million others, how we were being attacked. And what Facebook told me is, but Maria, you're a public figure. That's not true, right? Our constitution, like yours, actually gives protection for journalists. That protection was stripped away from journalists until, like, last month when Facebook added more protection for journalists. So where do I get justice for those few years? Anyway, to get back to your question today, I was just playing with the idea. I was going, you know, CNN, maybe it should just, we should take these tech platforms off Section 230. That's the first step, because the minute that you look at not the content but move upstream to the algorithms and how they are making editorial choices at scale, right, it's not a freedom of speech issue. It becomes the amplification and the changing of our behavior at scale, pumping lies, conspiracy theories, hate, anger, why? Keeps you on the platform, which means there's greater engagement, which means there's greater revenues to surveillance capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that's the second part. Who owns your data? Should you be the one to own it? Should surveillance capitalism be legal? Right? And I go back to like the 19th century when factors of production, the factory line, and child labor, and sweatshops were happening. And the moguls then said that this is important for our economy. And when the laws were changed, those very same guys who made so much money off of the wrong things then donated a lot of money to make up for all their crimes. Sorry, not their crimes. But I think that's it. I think we're at a moment where it's, and I think that's part of what the Nobel Committee saw. We are at, the last time a journalist was given this prize, a working journalist, was in 1936. And he languished in a Nazi concentration camp. It is the rise of fascism again, right? That was the time of Goebbels and radio and television. This is the time of the internet where all the incentive schemes for facts go against the facts. This is the rise of fascism. So what are we going to do? And I was just telling CNN, it's like we have to make it so that every day of no action costs the platforms. Because there are people like me, many more in worse situations who... There are people like you who are being insidiously manipulated without our knowledge.
So I think, one thing that is clear is that we need more transparency. We are still in the dark about how a lot of this operates under the hood. And so we have these debates in public now. Frances Haugen goes in front of Congress and she brings out tens of thousands of pages of documents. And she says, this is internal research that shows X, Y, and Z. And then Facebook says, oh, well, you cherry-picked that research. It's not representative. And if you look at what the research that we're publishing in our quarterly reports, it's the 99% number. We get 99% of the misinformation. So you've got these two competing narratives, and people are wondering, well, which of these is the truth? You know, like, is this cherry-picked research, or is it real? Is it causal? Is it randomized controlled trials? Or is Facebook's research, or is it somewhere in the middle? And I think part of the problem is that we don't have enough transparency to sort that out, you know? And we don't know what the causes or effects of algorithmic amplification are. We don't know what the causes or effects of, you know, some of this other stuff are in a way that we can go in there and turn societal dials to actually solve some of these problems. I'll give you an example. So Section 230, many people don't know that the purpose of Section 230 when it was originally written was to enable platforms to moderate content rather than to stop them from moderating content. The problem now, as you correctly point out, is that it's algorithmic. Which means that, is it an editorial decision when an algorithm is making it or not? And does this provide too much cover, or does this actually allow them to root out misinformation without the threat of civil liability? A lot of that we don't know the answer to because we don't know the inner workings of how moderation changes the amount of misinformation and its spread, what types of moderation, how you moderate algorithms, and you don't know that because you don't know how the algorithms work. The entire thing is a black box and it's completely opaque. Just to get to your point about journalism is light, and light is information is power. Where's the light? Where's the light in this process where we can see what we need to do? We're kind of fumbling in the dark. I've heard you use that analogy.
Except I lived through it, and we have the data for the Philippines, and we have genocide in Myanmar, and we have Russian disinformation operations in your US elections that has had a ripple effect around the world. We have Oxford University's computational propaganda research projects say that this year, in at least 81 countries around the world, cheap armies on social media rolled back democracy. So yes, the platforms can say 99%, but we lived through it. And we have watched. Look at America today, guys, right? And if you look at the data that was released by the Senate Intelligence Committee in December of 2018, you can see how their target, and you know that they reached 250 some odd million Americans, the target of the fracture lines of society is not on one side. They hit Black Lives Matter on both sides to manipulate you so you don't believe anything, so you are hateful and angry. So. CNN is this, like, he's very good at breaking it down so that the tech guys can see it. I'm a journalist. I see the impact. And for me, the impact already tells me that what the tech guys have done is untenable. And we have to find the right way forward. I think that's the message. And you will find the research that will back it. But
We need that because so
that's to convince
take
them,
political
though, right?
Polarization, the anger, okay, the political polarization. So when you look at the research on political polarization, you have this myriad causes. So going back to cable news. Cable news and the bifurcation of right and left on cable news and the extreme views that you see on cable news, coupled with sort of the public dialogue from the top, the politicians and their bifurcation across the political spectrum, is all going on. So when you ask political scientists who study political polarization and you ask them, you say, social media, does social media, is that responsible for political polarization? They say, well, I would put that probably 6th, 7th, or 8th on the list of things that cause political polarization in the United States.
Yochai Benkler, that's the study, right? Networked propaganda. But what Yochai did was to look at the amplification of the social media by traditional media. And so really, if you look at the United States, so again, with CNN, I lived through that golden age, and I remember when Fox came up. And then I felt it as the CNN reporter when the military or some State Department guys will tell me, you know, Fox is fairer to us than you are, right? I felt this, lived through it. Now that one, if you see it on Twitter in 2010, the Twitter map of the 2010 elections, did you see that one where they pulled down hashtag GOP? Mm-hmm. And then you see two circles on Twitter with a little bridge in between, 2010. Mm-hmm. That little bridge has gotten this way because it's pulled further. So yes, back to your point, it depends on what you're after. But I would submit that now in 2021, the evidence is overwhelming, that human rights, so the people who build this, who's building tech here, that, you know, I'm going to quote CNN to him, money, code, norms, and laws, right? The money, the business model, the code, there should be building codes for something that can hack our minds. Norms, the norms have changed. Anger and hate have increased. Polarization has increased. And then the laws. The best law that I see so far in draft, and we talk about this all the time, is the Digital Services Act of the EU, mm-hmm. the Democracy Action mm-hmm. Plan. But all of that will still take years. What happens to the Philippines and our elections on May 9, 2022, right? Again, we're the canary. You know, you can't have integrity of elections if you don't have integrity of facts. And we have a historical, like, shift of disinformation networks allied with Ferdinand Marcos Jr., Bongbong Marcos, where his father has gone from being the dictator that was ousted by people power in 1986 to a hero, right? So what happens to us? I think the last part of that is what happens to us will happen to you if you don't do anything now. Sorry, I'm getting hyper.
So I just want to just close the loop on that last conversation by saying I don't think it's fair to say, is it social media or is it the politicians or is it the media? This is an ecosystem.
Agreed.
They feed back into each other right. in such a way that you can't really isolate. You have to understand, and you said this earlier, that you have to understand how the system works. I want to switch gears for a second and ask you two final questions, which the first one is that, you know, you have lived through a tremendous amount of strain, attack, facing collectively 60 years, personally 6-7 years now just for the cyber libel charge. This is extreme. Extreme. So the question is, what keeps you going?
Rappler. I'm not alone. My co-founders, the moment in time, you know, like if I listened to my parents, I could have just stayed. But if I left, then I'm out on bail, guys. In less than 2 years, I got 10 arrest warrants. I think the worst mistake the government made was abusing their power by arresting me and keeping me overnight, just to let me feel their power. To me, it was just evidence of the abuse of power. I should have been released on bail immediately. So it matters, right? I mean, this is like a high-stakes game of chicken. You believe in the values or you don't. And just because someone is trying to scare you to not believe in it doesn't mean you have to do that. And I think that you know, my task is to hold up the sky so Rappler can continue doing its job. On November 10th, we released 10 articles, 10 pieces that showed it was the 186-page affidavit at the International Criminal Court of a hitman who Duterte told to kill people and who then told you where the bodies were buried, then connected to the corruption scandal that President Duterte is facing now. So do you do that story or not? I knew that if we did it, when I was given permission to travel, that was kind of cool. The palace knew, because we had already given them the questions they needed to answer. And it could have gone either way. I knew that by putting out those stories, I could lose my right to travel for the fifth time. But let's see where it all goes, right?
Speaking of that, I want to end with this question, which is, what is your advice to young adults who are now thinking about what they're going to do? Maybe they're journalists, maybe they're digital entrepreneurs, digital media and so on. Maybe they're not. But, you know, what would you tell the young adults of the world what they should be thinking about as they make their choices in the next set of years that they've got?
You're here because you're smart, you're ambitious. You're also privileged, right? And that's, I feel like the last 3 weeks, I've spoken with so many smart young people. And I say three things. Define for yourself what will make you happy, starting with how much money will you need, right? Because you have to grow your own power, right? Where does that, and that power comes from knowledge. That's why you're here. So what is it? What do you want in your life? Because you are the starting point. How do you see your world? And draw these lines now before you're tested. The lines that are clear, on this side you're good, on this side you're evil. And don't cross. Because later on, situational ethics, if your lines aren't clear, you will do the wrong thing, right? You will create things that will be bad for us. No one thinks they're the bad guys. Hitler didn't think he was the bad guy, right? If you don't draw those lines for yourself now, then someone so smart could do so many bad things. That's, I think that. And then for yourself, as you make your choices, that's the last thing. I keep saying that, you know, where does your family come in? How do you define happiness for yourself? And then, because one of the things to me that never really, when corruption comes calling, I was happy with what I was making. So it's very easy to say no, right? I had three jobs when I was in college and I was just happy I could pay my bills. So it kind of depends on your sense of where you want. Do you want to build like Mark Zuckerberg? A Facebook. How are you going to do that, taking into account all the lessons that you can see already? How does it fit your personal values? It goes down to that. It's your values and your principles and how you live it and how you'll be tested.
So make ethics a priority, have them come first, and then have everything follow from there rather than try to figure out what the ethics are after
later,
you've gotten
right?
into the situation. That's
yeah.
Very interesting.
Next up, Sinan and Maria reconnect to discuss the results of the recent election in the Philippines.
Maria, I have to start with the election outcomes in the Philippines because the election outcomes are clearly historic. You know, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., continued the political dynasty in winning the presidency. But it goes a lot deeper than that, right? His sister is a senator until 2025. His son was elected as a congressman. And the Duterte family as well did well in the sense that his daughter was elected vice president. His eldest son was reelected to Congress. His younger son is now the mayor of Davao City. So I just want to ask you, what is your reflection on the state of democracy in the Philippines, given the election outcomes?
I mean, I think we're emblematic of the state of democracy globally. We were the first domino to fall in 2016. You know, the election of Rodrigo Duterte happened in May 2016, and then you had Brexit a little more than a month later, and so on. Trump elected, the Catalonia elections, Jair Bolsonaro. And now, after that, that was really a warning sign, right? And then now we have, I think we could have recovered. Now we've fallen off the abyss. And I mean, two extremely worrying trends that I think are existential for democracy. The first is really I've talked about an atom bomb exploding in our information ecosystem when social media platforms now deliver the news, right? So the world's largest delivery platform for news is Facebook. But these platforms actually prioritize the spreading of lies over facts. That is your research that first did that in 2018, Sinan. So then beyond that, right, we have these platforms that are powered by surveillance capitalism, which Shoshana Zuboff named it was that new. And then you have this something that has always been there in the cycles of history, which is when things become extremely complex, extremely difficult, people in every country around the world, we called it nostalgia for authoritarian rule. Because I began my career 36 years ago in the Philippines, right soon after the People Power Revolt. So I covered the spread of democracy globally in our region. And then now what you're seeing is, and I think I would peg this around 2014, which was when India elected Modi, who himself in 2004 was actually charged with human rights violations, not officially, but he couldn't enter the United States because of it. Then he became prime minister in 2014. In 2014, in Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim population, the country with the world's largest Muslim population, almost elected General Prabowo Subianto, the son-in-law of former President Suharto. I covered the end of almost 32 years of Suharto in 1998. And this is kind of that shift, right? The more things change, the more people felt like they were on quicksand. And as you've seen in the United States, that demographic change then began to be utilized by populist leaders. And these populist leaders used an us against them style of leadership, a way of being that circumvented a lot of the checks and balances of democracy, of journalism. Well, we'll go to that. But I mean, in terms of an in-group and an out-group, and we're back to a place that we haven't been to, I think, since 1930s, late 30s, 35. And, you know, in the Nobel lecture, I called it, that was the last time a journalist had won a Nobel Peace Prize, was in 1935.
Wow. That's a historic coming back around. And I want to get to the Nobel lecture and congratulate you on that. But do you think that the media ecosystem and the social media ecosystem is fueling or is a tool of this populist rise?
So these are the two trends that are coming together, right? There's that nostalgia. World needs to be simpler. In many ways, the election of Barack Obama and gay marriage, and you know, it these changes became too much. And then you had this go hand in hand with this information ecosystem that actually prioritized lies, anger, hate over facts, thinking slow, right? Distribution, the widest distribution, is amped up by what I started calling toxic sludge, the worst of humanity. And this is what we're seeing, which to me, Sina, you know, we fell off the abyss. I certainly hope I'm wrong, but I wasn't wrong in 2016. I certainly hope that other democracies, including the United States, don't go down this route.
Well, I mean,
because if we do, right?
Well, you see, even in the United States, extreme polarization, affective political polarization for sure. And you definitely see a rolling back. I mean, you see the Supreme Court.
Roe versus Wade.
voice to overturn Roe versus Wade. And a lot of the commentary on that says that's just the first domino to fall, that there will be other rights that will be rolled back. And obviously you have state by state legislation. But I want to ask you, prior to congratulating you on your Peace Prize, which we'll get to, how are you? You have a court case going on. You have a whirlwind of activity. I just want to know how you are.
I've embraced the uncertainty, and I've embraced that we are going to go through a time of intense chaos. I think it's going to get worse. I hope I'm wrong. Please prove me wrong. But where the U.S. is going, I'm actually in Toms River, New Jersey right now. You know, I'm in where I went to high school. This is the 40th year since I graduated high school, and my high school dedicated an auditorium, right? So they named the auditorium after me, but I'm back. And what was so fascinating to me is talking to high school students in the United States. I went to public high school, and, you know, Ocean County, Toms River is primarily Republican, but the rift in my own family. I have family here, the head of the Manchester. Well, my classmate is the head of the Toms River Police, somebody I graduated with. My cousin, Vinny, is a captain in the Manchester Police. I have a cousin, Vinny. But, you know, the thing here is that, right? I actually understand these divisions. And I when I talked to the high school students yesterday, I was just saying, this kind of, when did politics become this like gladiator spectator sport where you take no prisoners? We'd never lived through anything like this. And this is part of the reason I blame not just the information ecosystem that's insidiously manipulating us. Your book says some of this, but I would push it a step further. I think they know they've done this. They've manipulated our biology. It cuts across globally, and the impact is horrendous. And we now have the data to do that. But then beyond that, it's creating a generation of Americans, of Filipinos, of people everywhere around the world. It's emergent human behavior that is the worst of who we are, you know, and that means our politics becomes untenable. We cannot find a shared reality if we don't have a shared set of facts.
Maria, we are so thankful that you have spent your time with us, but we are even more thankful as a society that you do what you do in the face of everything that you face. And all I can say is thank you, thank you, thank you.
The Digital Insider with Sanaa Narelle is brought to you by the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, hosted by Sanaa Narelle, produced and edited by Carrie Reynolds. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Share today's episode and tag us on social media at MIT_IDE. To leave a voicemail for Sanaa for the chance to have your question answered live on air in a future episode, call 617-468-8423, or you can email mitdigitalinsider@gmail.com. Visit our website, ide.mit.edu/podcast, for more.